Zesty Garden, and I have a special guest this morning. I'm talking with Jan Brett, who's author of so many wonderful books that you may or probably already have in your own library, like Christmas Trolls, There's the Mitten, and now you're on tour with The Turnip.
With The Turnip. That's my new one. It's a Russian folktale that many librarians will be familiar with, but I put a new twist in mine, which is... Shall I tell?
I like the twist.
You like the twist? Okay, so I do borders in my books. It's when I have too many ideas, and then I just put them in the borders, and sometimes you can see who's coming next in the borders. Well, in the story, they find a giant turnip in the garden, and then everyone tries to pull it up, but they're not able to. The discoverer is a little girl, and then she asks her brother, her mother, her father, and various animals, including a hedgehog. They can't pull it up. Meanwhile, there's a rooster who's escaped from a neighboring farm. He's escaped from the cooking pot. He's watching the action. But being a rooster, he's a little bit cocky and sure of himself, and he says, oh, I can pull up the turnip all by himself. So he grasps the turnip top with his little beak and starts to pull. And at the same time, I have foreshadowed this whole scenario of a mother bear going to down to her den for her winter hibernation with her two cubs. You see them brushing their teeth and getting a story and getting in their pajamas. And as they go down into the den, you turn the page, and what is in their bed but the giant turnip? This is from underground. You see the great big root of it right where, and it's a beautiful, beautiful turnip. It's purple on the top, yellow on the bottom. So they see this and, oh, how can we go to sleep for the winter? So Mother Bear gets her foot out just as upstairs in the ground. You see the turnip top, and there's a little rooster. Kaboom! The whole turnip goes up in the air, and the rooster is hanging on for dear life, and everyone thinks he has pulled up the turnip.
And of course, he becomes the hero.
He's the hero, and he gets a new home, because the badger family, they are the ones who are the farmers in the story. The father badger says, well, when could we find a helpful fellow like this again? So please come and live with us, he says. Hedgehogs are my totem animal. I love them. They're European, but it's something about that little nose that kind of turns up. They dig under leaves and things for bugs. And then because of their prickles, they don't have to run away or scratch. So people see them, even though they're wild animals, they may, you know, congregate around people's houses and get, you know, little scraps of food and things like that.
And it's the hedgehog that eventually... Is it that gets everyone to come out of, in your other book, The Mitten?
Yes. Well, the hedgehog is in all of my books, but especially the hat where he gets a sock stuck in his head because he gets into it. It falls off the clothesline, and he has to pretend it's a hat so that other animals don't tease him. And then finally, the little girl rescues her sock. It was her woolens that were out there airing. And so that's a happy ending for that one. And The Mitten... All the animals get inside, and a bear comes in, the very last animal, and then, oh no, the last animal is a mouse, gets onto the bear's nose. The bear feels that scoochy scratchy of the claws and sneezes, and then all the animals get catapulted out of the mitten. The mitten goes up in the sky, and Nicky, the little boy who has lost his mitten, sees it.
You illustrate your books as well.
Yes. Ever since I was in kindergarten, I wanted to be a children's book illustrator. You may know someone like that yourself that loves to color and draw, and I was really shy. Nothing ever came out right when I tried to talk. But then when I drew a picture, it was almost like I could create this world, and I was something inside was happy. And so I have to keep doing it. So everyone says to me, you know, how long are you going to keep doing books? And as long as I can, as long as I can see and can hold a pencil, I will be drawing books.
So why a turnip? It's not exactly what I would think would be the subject of a book.
That's why it's the perfect subject, because it's the giant turnip. I guess because it's a Russian folktale. And I guess the idea of a huge, giant vegetable has some appeal. And as I've been on the book tour and talked about it being a Russian folktale, various people have said, well, I'm Chinese. We had this as a Chinese folktale. And a Romanian woman said, this is not a Russian folktale. This is a Romanian folktale. So I guess it spread. Because I like to tell the children that a folktale, I define a folktale, it's one of those stories that you love so much that you tell it to your children. Then your children love it, and they remember it. When they grow up and have their children, they tell it. And it goes down the generations, each person embellishing it a little bit. So that it gets better and better.
How did you find out about this tale?
I spent a lot of time in libraries, and especially when I was a little girl. We had a library down the street. We used to ride our bikes. We could put six books on one side of our, you know, the saddlebags you used to have, six on the other, 12 was the limit, and we would just take out zillions of books. And I love folk tales because I love the influence of the foreign countries, because it would be tales from Japan, tales from Russia, tales from Germany, the Scandinavian ones, and I just thought they were very interesting.
So it's kind of like Cinderella. I've noticed that there's a tale of Cinderella in almost all cultures. My daughter was just in Cambodia, and there's something along the lines of Cinderella in Cambodia as well.
Yeah. So must be something very basic about some of these stories that cross all these cultural lines that is very key to our human spirit. Possible?
I think you're right. So I'm imagining you have a whole list of books that you could write based on tales like this. So why did the turnip one appeal to you the most?
I think that colors of the turnip, I mean, it's kind of a pinky magenta-y purple, and that yellow is such a dramatic color combination. And I mean, anybody who goes to a fresh market, you just can't help but be bowled over by the beautiful colors that you see with the bright green greens and the oranges of the carrots and the tomatoes. And I mean, look, we describe so many colors by describing fruits and vegetables. You know, it's like a color of corn, you know, new corn, or it's leafy green, or they just are so beautiful. Those pigments are so rich. And so...
So you're looking at it from not only the cultural end of things, you're looking at it like, how can I illustrate this as well?
Absolutely. I would say that's what really drives me, is the colorfulness of it. And then also I was able to go to Russia and do, you know, grueling research. We had to go to museums and eat Russian food and take hot steam baths called banyas, and had all these adventures. We went to this town. It was the ancient capital of Russia, called Novgorod. And the architecture is very beautiful. It's somewhat like our Victorian architecture, where there's like little zigzags and curlicues carved in the wood, and then it goes around the doorways, on the gables, between floors, around the windows. And this was, think of that, but then multiply it by 3-4 layers, but all gray, all wood with no paint. So then it would turn this lovely weathered gray color. And then you top it off with the onion dome, which I don't know why they're not called turnip domes, because they look more like turnips to me.
So when you're doing research, and I've heard that you do intensive research in your books. Normally you would think, okay, for a children's book, you don't have to do very much. But really, when you're illustrating, you're telling a story with what you're drawing, as well as what the printed word is.
Well, you know, it's just like food. When you go to a different country, if you go to Mexico and they put chocolate in the savory things, and when you go to a different country, it kind of sparks different ways of seeing color. Like when we went to Martinique, I set my book Owl and the Pussycat there. It was actually written by Edward Lear, but I did the illustrations. And the colors of the jungle, the blue ocean, and then all those boats and houses with all these contrasting bright colors. Colors you wouldn't expect. It was wonderful. You know, it just made me feel like, wow, for school's out, I can put anything I want in this book. And then when we went to the Arctic, this is an interesting one, because there, we were in Baffin Island. It's winter pretty much every month, except for 3 weeks is summer. That's their summer. And the colors of the ocean against the ice, the greens, emerald greens and blues and turquoise, and the glaciers would be all these lovely colors. And then when the sun hit them, all these pinks and everything, but the white and then all the fur that the Inuit people would wear, especially in the olden days. Now, they sometimes will use a regular cloth that we might get at North Face or whatever the big ski place might be that sells high-tech fabric, but they still use the fur because it's really the only thing that will keep them warm, and seal skin and so forth. And those browns and grays, and they would use different furs for different times of the year. And so I was able to make that book all these shades of gray and brown, and then the shades of the blue and the green. And that was really exciting to me, because I wouldn't have come up with that in Boston, Massachusetts. I had to go to Baffin Island to get to get those idea of just like editing, you know, editing it down to those two color groups.
When you first step off the plane into a new country, what's coming to your eyes first?
You know, when I first come, I almost contract, because I don't know, you feel like a stranger, and then you just kind of open up. Now, when we've gone to Africa, it was also like, am I going to do the right thing? Because there you're constantly being told, if you see an elephant, don't run. You're supposed to just kind of ease back into the where you can be safe. But, you know, a lot of the prey animals will see a running figure, and all they'll say is, oh, that's something to eat if it's running. So you're told never to run. So it takes me a little while, I think. I mean, that's why it's usually good to go for a couple of weeks.
So you can just sit back and observe?
Yeah. But, you know, it's funny. The books are visual, but when I'm making them up, I'm smelling the smells, I'm feeling the wind or the heat or the cold and all the different sounds. Like, the best thing about Africa was the morning chorus. Just as the sun goes up, you're hearing the lions roaring from the night's kill. You know, over their kill, they roar. First time I heard it, I thought it was a train. I said, Joe, I hear a train. That's my husband. He goes, Jan, we're a million miles from anywhere. That's not a train. What could it be? And we asked our guy. He says, oh, those were the lions. They had a kill, you know, X amount of miles away. And then the birds start, and then hyenas. And it's called the morning chorus. It is exactly like a symphony. Hippos. The bird life is amazing. They all each have their own little specialty.
So, well, with the turnip, do you like turnips?
I love turnips. We always have them on special occasions, and occasionally another time. My mother was quite a good cook, and she was very good about making us homemade meals. I have to admit, we often would have them with a little honey or brown sugar, but not always. And then I was the one who, because of the book, wanted to do the pancakes, because the last page, that's the payoff. They all get turnip pancakes. And I had to make them. And so I just took a potato recipe from Joy of Cooking, my old standby, and put half turnips in it. But I still followed all the rules of, like, you squeeze the moisture out of the grated turnip and potato and let it sit for a little while before adding the three eggs. And I have my own chicken, so I was able to use their eggs, which always makes me happy. They're very tasty. And then I think there's a tablespoon of flour, salt and pepper, and my secret ingredient was just a little grind of nutmeg. You know, with the fresh nutmeg? That was my secret ingredient. And then brown in butter, which is in the book. I put a little olive oil, too. And then Joe and I had them as a savory dish. We had them with smoked salmon, creme fraiche, and capers. And then when our grandkids come, they have them with applesauce.
How do you continue to do book after book and remain inspired? I'm sure part of it is traveling and seeing everything that's around you.
You know, that's such an intuitive question, because, you know, for me, it's the opposite. If I don't draw, I get this, like, worthless, flabby feeling. I feel like, oh, my gosh, my life is going by, and I'm not using... It's not that I feel like I'm terribly gifted, but I feel like this is some kind of magic thing that's been given to me to be able to communicate. And I love being in touch with my six-year-old self, which is that kind of person that gets up on Saturday morning, 5 o'clock in the morning, shakes your parents, can I get up? Can I go outside? Can I do this? Can we go here? And they go, and your parents roll over, and they go, well, how about we have breakfast first? And, you know, it's that feeling and discovery, just going out in the backyard and seeing, you know, I loved flowers, and we had these big fields in the back, and it was just every week in the spring and summer, there would be something new that was going on back there that we'd go. We had a little apple orchard that was from the olden days, so it was kind of falling down, and different animals would come from the woods. They still do. We have even more animals now than we used to when I was growing up.
Well, you definitely have an eye for detail. How were you influenced growing up to pay attention to things so you can see that detail?
That's a really good question. I think two things. One was we were told to go not watch TV. We just had to go outside, or we could draw. We were given art materials, not lessons, but we had a lot of time. And I had this best friend, Marla, and we just drew. We loved horses, but we neither of us could have a horse. So we drew our horses, and we gave them saddles and blankets and names and stalls, which we all drew and cut out. And it was just a world that we created. And she was a much better artist than me. So I always was playing catch-up to her art because she was such a good... So I was just really lucky to have this best friend. That was one thing. And what was the other thing I was going to say about the detail? I know we were read to a lot, and my favorite author was Beatrix Potter. And the books that I loved had all the detail, because I can remember, like, it was the roly-poly pudding, and John Joyner was a carpenter, and he was up on the slates of the roof. And I, what are slates? But you could almost feel the heat coming off of them, you know, from her drawings, and all the little squirrels would have little tassels on their ears. We don't have that in New England. I go, look at those tassels on their ears. And then I remember I had this book, wonderful book about the Arabian Nights. And of course, I loved horses. And it had an Arab horse on the cover with this man on it with a turban and a jewel. And the illustrator had made a little rip in the satin of the covering on the horse's back, as if he had been in some sort of scrape, either a battle or been through some big woods or something. And I thought, wow, you know, just by that little detail you could tell the story has already started. And then, you know, an Arab horse has more of a dished-in face in its skull. And so I said, I knew what an Arab horse was. I said, if it's Arabian Nights, Arab horse. And it was like a light bulb. So after that, I tried to always match up everything. Like in this book, it's a European badger because it's set in Russia. So we have a North American badger, has more of a pointy nose. But the European badger has more of a clown-like nose.
So we just need to be aware when we're looking at the book, if we think, oh, that doesn't quite look like a badger. Well, it does look like a badger. It's just not a North American badger.
It's a European badger, yeah. So I just always love the kind of puzzle aspect of it. And I think children naturally do that. They love to learn new words. They love to learn about other countries. They love to learn about animals and the world around them. And it's only when I think we get older that we kind of get stressed and we don't have that openness about our ability to absorb.
What would you suggest for parents with their kids today? I know when I was growing up, Atari was just coming out. Uh-huh. But nowadays, I see my son, he wants to be on the iPad, and we're constantly, we have a TV downstairs, but we never watch it.
Yeah.
So it's, and his best friend lives next door, and they like to go out and explore. But even the electronics are still kind of alluring. What would you suggest to get kids outside so that they are exploring and looking for that kind of detail?
Now, I'm really in a position now. You know, I have a granddaughter. You know, my daughter's all grown up, so I've had my chance with her. But we just plan a lot of outdoor activities. We go for a lot of walks. We go for a lot of hikes. We go out and feed the chickens. We just have a lot of activities. And I think her parents don't have every single hour of her life planned, so she has time to just go out and explore and have that kind of dead time where you have to ask yourself, what should I do? And I think that is kind of gets our imagination going a little bit, where it's not all given to us in a silver platter of like, oh, this is your uniform and this is where you're going to play today, that kind of thing. I mean, some of that is great. I mean, it's good to stay fit by being an athlete and being on a team or taking lessons. But I guess it's a little balance. I think every parent like knows when they see their kids, you know, what they should do. But, you know, the human spirit is a lovely thing. And I think that no matter if it's electronics or books or it's whatever one's creative mode is, that the human spirit will prevail no matter what, and that we'll have human beings that are curious and knowledgeable and want to share that knowledge and love.
Well, I'm talking with Jan Brett. She's author of, her new book is The Turnip. You may know her from The Mitten or Christmas Trolls. And she's in Logan, Utah, and actually traveling through Utah. I think you were in Salt Lake a little earlier, and you're headed to St. George. And why don't you tell me about the tour?
The best part of the tour is a lot of the children will bring me their drawings. And they're so great. They're unedited. You know, there's no one saying, oh, the nose is too big or whatever. And they're so expressive. I love them. And I always say, you know, that's better than I can do. And they look at me like in disbelief, like, no, it's not. And I'm like, yes, it is. It's fantastic. And a lot of the children do want to be artists when they grow up. And they all love their books. And I would say that they're not unsung heroes, because everybody loves our teachers, but the teachers do such a great job having children that may not have books at home or may not have that time to draw. They make that time in school. It's wonderful.
I would say probably, as a parent, for me, the best thing that we could have done with our kids was to read. And our daughter's now 21. Our son is now 13, but he'll still climb into my lap and we'll just pull out a book, even though he could easily read it on his own.
You know, there's so many wonderful ways to enjoy books. My daughter had a really hard time learning to read, which I did not. It was easy for me, and it was hard for me to accept that. But we just had books everywhere. You know, big coffee table books on owls, on, you know, traveling or underwater. And so she just liked the idea of just opening a book and seeing something cool. But then every night we read together. So it was way beyond her reading level, but it was at her comprehension level. So it's a wonderful way to introduce children to new ideas, especially if they aren't able to decode an actual book to read to them. It's great to see what they're interested in and what they ask for over and over again. And it's a great way for me, because I read to her when she was in ninth grade. We didn't tell all our friends that, because it sounds babyish. But we did. We read Gone with the Wind and some books that had touched on adult subjects. And it was a great time for me to be able to tell what I thought about certain things without me having to, you know, say, I think you should do this. Instead, I'd be sympathizing with one of the characters, or, you know, maybe there would be subjects that might be difficult, death, or like the Little House on the Prairie books with the big winter, I think it was, when they were, you know, practically starving and they had to struggle through this very, very cold winter and all had to help each other, and then the neighbors that had the corn that they lent them, and, you know, just all those like small little lessons that make up the fabric of life, but you're getting to steal them from other cultures and other situations and other families that you might not have yourself. And that just kind of frame of reference, I think, is a wonderful way for a child to grow up, having that frame of reference.
I want to change the subject here a little bit and ask you about the tour itself. How do you keep up your energy going from town to town? This is, how many books have you authored?
I don't know. Oh, you mean how many books have I actually written and illustrated? It's around 36.
Is that 36 tours that you've been on?
Well, yeah, we've been on a lot of book tours. And, you know, what it is all year long I'm by myself. Our kids are grown up, and I have my husband, which we always chat and everything, but it's like being in a bubble. I mean, I get surround myself with things that have to do with the book, and I'm just in this bubble. And I do other things, but mostly that's what I do, and like not going to an office. And then to come out and meet people that like the books, it's so heartwarming, and I'm almost in disbelief, and someone will know all the characters and quote from them. And like there's this one book, The Trouble with Trolls, and so the little girl has her dog, and she's going up the mountain, and the trolls try to take the dog away. They want a pet. And they go, "I want dog." And they, some family said, "Oh, we always have that, I want dog." And they talk like the trolls. And it's very cute.
I have to tell you, that was one of my favorite books always to read to my kids, because I like to do voices. And the troll sounded like this. And so I would change my voice and go around. So your books are very easy to do that with and to have fun while you're reading.
They are very fun. I love, my grandfather used to be a great reader out loud. And my father, too, would always do the voices of the three bears. And when we got to the great gruff voice of the father bear, then we would be like, we'd pretend to be scared. And, of course, it would be an excuse to stay up another half an hour because we would have to be calmed down after that.
Well, the last thing I wanted to ask you about has not really anything too related to the turnip, other than the hero, supposed hero of the book, is a rooster.
Yeah.
I am sitting here in on your bus,
yeah,
and there are two banties right behind me.
Yes, it's
and
Ruben.
You love chickens, I understand.
I love chickens. I was always a horse person. Well, I had chickens when I was little. And then I always loved horses and had horses for years. And then we traveled so much, it was very difficult to keep a horse and keep in shape for my riding. So I started running and I started raising chickens. And now I have about 150. And I go all over the country going to chicken poultry shows. And the best thing about poultry shows is just so much darn fun at these shows. We're very competitive, and there are all these beautiful breeds. There's like 72 breeds of large fowl and bantams, and then, of course, you have ducks and turkeys. And I have friends all over the country. And so I have this little pair, our Dutch, light brown Dutch, and they look just like the one in the book because I copied him. And he was given to me by a breeder of Dutch chickens. Is the smallest of the bantams, which I thought would be good because it kind of emphasizes the fact this little teeny rooster pulls up the giant turnip. But I have the white-crested Polish chickens.
Oh, I love those.
You
I love
do?
Those. I used to have some white-crested Polish. Now I have Dominiques and a golden Campine. I'm not one of these people that raises chickens to eat necessarily. I like to have a little variety,
yeah,
in my flock, and I like the different colored eggs, and so I understand your appreciation for
and
chickens.
They make great in addition to your garden. Mm-hmm. So you know, you have to keep the manure so that it will season. Is that the word you would use?
They would compost.
Yeah, they would compost it. Yeah, so we have a compost, and I use the chicken cleanup from the chicken coops. And my chickens do have a very nice area that they live in. We have a lot of predators. Mm. So they need a roof. The Polish have this big, huge picture, a black chicken with shiny iridescent feathers, almost bottle green, and then a great big white softball-sized poof of white instead of a comb. Almost obscures their eyes. So they cannot be rained on.
It's like a little top hat.
It's like a top. Some people call them top hatters. But they're very sweet. All my roosters are really nice, and my Dutch rooster is really nice.
Well, Ms. Brett, thank you very much.
You are very welcome.
You've been listening to The Zesty Garden. My guest has been Jan Brett, and she's here in Logan on a book tour for her latest book. It's called The Turnip, and it's from Putnam, and I hope that you'll take a gander at it because it's just wonderful. The illustrations are great. The story is nice, and if you want a good book to sit with whomever to read, this will be one of those. I'm talking with Jerry Goodspeed. He's Utah State University's Extension Horticulturist, and the Witness Protection Program for the Poinsettia Program is kind of on my mind. I saw a video that you that you did about this, and you know, it's a very serious thing, right?
Yeah, I'm sorry for laughing. Yeah, it is. We see a lot of poinsettias that are only used for about 2 to 3 weeks and then discarded.
Well, and if anyone has a green thumb, they just don't want to throw it out. It just feels unclean.
It's wrong. Yeah, you've spent your money. You've invested a little bit of time into it, and it's growing. It's looking good, and then the Christmas season is over, and then you're thinking, I can't get rid of this. This guy's still good. Well, and so you stick them somewhere in your house to try to keep them alive.
Sometimes it's also genetics. My mother, just everything she touched just goes green. And so, of course, when I moved out on my own and wanted to keep my poinsettia, I thought, well, I can do this until next year. I'll just keep it growing. And I went through the whole process of putting it in the dark, bringing it out, putting it in the dark every night. And, well, I got it to redden up again, but it didn't look like it did the year before.
Yeah, they, you know, poinsettias are a very interesting plant to me because a lot is invested into the growing of them and getting them just perfect and just right. And as I've said before, then they live for about 3 weeks in our house if they're lucky, healthy-wise, and that's it. And, you know, as you had mentioned, as a plant person, people that like to grow things, that's just wrong. I mean, and it is difficult. And to get them to, one of the tricks is to get them to color up. And what you did is really good because a lot of people don't even get that. You know, they'll just stick them in their house, and then next year they're looking kind of leggy usually, and then they'll try to get them to color up. Or they won't even know how to get them to color up, and then they'll just stay green all season, and then they get frustrated and throw them out.
Well, they're so touchy. I mean, you can't give them too much water. You can't let them dry out. I mean, they're even my African violets, if I let them go too long without water, they'll still perk back up. But if you let a poinsettia go without water and the leaves start to droop, they don't undroop.
That's very true. They are a very touchy plant. And it's a, you know, if you can get it to survive, which tells me you're very good, and live for a year, let alone get it to color up, that's pretty incredible.
Well, I guess what I've found out is it's just not worth it. I mean, when you can buy one in the store for $6 or $7 for even a very basic one, it's worth my time and money to say, I'm sorry, you've got to go, get rid of it, and then just wait till next year, get another one.
Yep, you served your purpose. And that's really hard for a lot of people, but that's what I have found, too. We have also kept them over from year to year. Apart from coloring them up is what you have said, is keeping them healthy so that they look. But you have to realize that in the greenhouse, when they grow them, they use all sorts of light, heat, even some hormones to get them to look the way they look, because we as a public have demanded this perfect poinsettia now, and so there's a lot of effort that goes into them. And you're correct about them being very fussy. In fact, you can put them into your house and put them into a room that has a draft in it, and after a couple of days, they'll start dropping their leaves.
And after a couple of days, you'll want them to get drafted so they leave your house. So they don't
That's
like
true.
Direct light, but they don't like not having enough indirect light. So if you want to try and keep this plant at least healthy for a couple of months just to see what happens, what are the keys?
Well, normally what we'll tell people is go ahead and keep it kind of where you know, don't move them. They don't like to be moved. So once you think that it's happy and you've got it, leave it there until it starts to drop some of those colorful leaves. And then actually what we will do is cut them way back. We'll cut them back to just a few buds, a few leaves left on them, and then we'll slow them down. We'll put them into a cooler room if we can and slow them down, keep them watering. And then about the time that, if you really want to do it good, then about to May, when we're done with our freezes and stuff, you'll actually go and find a shady place outside and dig it into the ground and let it grow there. You can even keep it in the pot or put it in a bigger pot, but kind of put it in the ground, and then it'll grow a lot better outside than it will inside. Again, it's not a full sun, a little bit of shady place, and then about September, first part of September, you bring it back in, and then you do the what you have said, the trick of putting it into dark.
How long?
Well, normally what we tell people is when the sun goes down, it should get dark. When the sun comes up, it should get light. So as soon as you see the sunset, throw it into a closet or put a bag over it. And you have to be consistent. You know, you can't do this for a week and then forget for a few days and then do it again for a week. You've got to be very consistent about it. Did you tell me that you were throwing it into a closet? Is that what you did?
Yeah, I had a closet because I had been told that if you start this process and even turn the light on in the room, then that completely resets the plant and you have to start over again. So I was diligently putting it in this closet back in the corner, keeping it dark. I can never turn the light on in the closet, so it was really hard to see my clothes in the morning. But, you know, I diligently did that, and sure enough, it did start to come out. But when I saw the results of what I was getting, I just thought, this isn't worth it.
Yep, that's exactly right. It is. You do have to be very diligent, and I don't know about you, but I'm, well, apparently you are. I'm not. I will have forgotten it, or maybe even leave it in the closet for a couple of days.
Well, this is back when I was younger and had more energy to worry about it. So,
well, yeah, normally today what I will tell people is enjoy it while you can, love it, and then say your farewell and let it go.
Do you, if you do try this process, how long do you have to keep putting it in the dark and bringing it out?
Usually about 4 to 6 weeks.
Okay, so that's a long time. And it can't be too warm or too cold?
Nope.
So what are the, what's
or
the
too
right
wet
temperature?
Or too dry.
So you still have to keep watering it, of course,
yep.
while it's
oh,
there.
Yeah.
Is it going to drop all of its leaves while it's in this dark, or is it getting enough sunlight
nope.
during the daytime?
Yeah, during the day should be fine. So what'll happen is during the day it's still got to be in light. That's why it's consistent taking it out into the light and then putting it back into the dark, putting it in the light, just as if it was in nature. So what you're trying to do is simulate it as if it was outside. And that's why I say when the sun goes down, it goes into the closet. When the sun comes up, it comes out of the closet and comes into a place that has some filtered light. Some filtered sunlight so that it still thinks it's in a natural setting, and you get the light, and then you get the dark, and then you get the light, and it should be healthy. Again, the thing that you're not doing in a house setting is you're not giving it the proper heat. Normally in the evenings, of course, it'll cool off. So when you set it in the closet, it should be cooling off and then warming up a little bit more in the day, which affects the growth of the plant as well. Because if it's always warm, then it pushes a little bit more than you want it to. It gets a little bit leggy. So it's just as important to cool it off in that dark period.
But they don't like it too cold. I mean, they're even worse than basil. I mean, they don't like it below 50.
That's true. When I say cool it off, it's usually down to about 60.
Okay. And then how do you know, watering-wise, if you've given too much or not enough, how far down should it be?
Oh,
yeah, it dies. How far down should it be at dry before you know it's time to water?
I would normally look at about a knuckle on your finger.
Okay. And any fertilizer?
Yes. Especially going into this process, we'll give a little bit of water-soluble fertilizer,
and
something that you could just pick up in any store.
For those poinsettias that have been left out to fend for themselves and will grow for food, this is your poinsettia protection program.
Well, for them, not much.
they can find a nice dumpster for a home?
Any kind of protection at all. Set them in a little overpass. Anything just to give them a little bit of protection, and they'll usually be okay. They'll figure out. A lot of them will travel south, actually.
Okay.
They'll realize that this is much too cold, and if you'll see them out every once in a while out on the road hitchhiking, consider throwing them at least into the back of the truck.
Getting
them how far south they can get.
You've been listening to The Zesty Garden. It's Jerry Goodspeed. He's USU's extension horticulturist, and we've been talking about poinsettias. Jerry, thanks for joining me this morning.
My pleasure, Brian.
Oh, happy good morning to you all. Here we are in January, back again, and looking at our lovely landscape of snow. And I am going to read to you, I've actually found something about turnips, which is the subject of the day. And it's from one of my favorite books about food, which is called How Carrots Won the Trojan War, by Rebecca Rupp. It's just curious accounts and with a little history and anecdotes of different foods. And believe it or not, she has a whole chapter about turnips, which kind of floored me as they've never been high on my list of beloved vegetables, although they're like right at the top for my husband, who likes to chomp them raw, just like an apple. So we will read today about turnips
and there's even a little song about them we should look up, by Duke Ellington, and there's a little smidgen of the lyrics here. Tulip or turnip, rosebud or rhubarb, fillet or plain beef stew. Tell me, tell me, tell me, dream face, what am I to you? That is Duke Ellington, one of our old favorites. Anyway, Rebecca Rupp writes about turnips, that the turnip's finest hour occurred at dinner time in the 16th century, when, carved in the shape of a castle, cathedral, or sailing ship, it served as a fantastic centerpiece on the grandest of aristocratic tables. Since then, it's been a steady slide from glory. The turnip historically is the favored food of cows, pigs, and desperate peasants. Fewer and fewer gardeners these days bother to grow them, and younger diners presented with them have a tendency to push them fretfully around on their plates and hide them under the mashed potatoes. Still, people have been growing turnips since the Neolithic era, and turnip seeds saved in pots have been found in Swiss lake dwellings. Plant scientists hypothesize dual centers of origin for the now-neglected turnip, one in the eastern Mediterranean, the other in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Oldest of the cultivated turnips is thought to be an Asian one, commonly known as rape, grown for its oil-bearing seeds. Rape seed oil, used in lamps since ancient times, was the oil of choice in the 19th century for illuminating lighthouses and lubricating steam locomotives. It's still around today, tastefully renamed canola oil, and it's commonly used in cooking. The first turnip cultivated in Europe, however, was Brassica, the garden turnip, grown for its edible roots. The Romans ate them, but even though the first century cookbook Apicius includes upper-class recipes for duck with turnips and turnip pickles with myrtle berries and boiled turnips steamed with cumin, honey, and vinegar, the Roman turnip was ordinarily considered poverty food. It was similarly a cottage rather than a castle vegetable during the Middle Ages. In England, turnips appeared on the occasional family coat of arms to indicate a benefactor of the poor. Medicinally, the turnip, mashed and mixed with suet, was recommended for winter maladies, such as frozen feet, chilblains, and aching joints. It was also used to treat gout, smallpox, and measles, and to make a nice soap for beautifying the face, a custom that may have been handed down from Roman times, when Apicius urged the wrinkle-conscious to use facial masks made out of cooked turnip cream and mashed rosebuds. Two applications, he claimed, would leave the aging face as smooth as a baby's thigh. Less frivolously, professional 16th-century cutlers used turnip juice to temper steel, and individuals with nothing better to drink fermented the turnips and turned them into alcohol. Because of the turnip's generally lousy press, turnip eater traditionally meant lower-class dullard. Let the low-born dig turnips was a German catchphrase dating to the 14th century, and in Old French, anything conspicuously worthless was deemed not worth a turnip. François Rabelais, in his bawdy 16th century satire, Gargantua and Pantagruel, referred to country bumpkins as turnip chewers, and German scholar Johannes Trithemius, who wrote the world's first printed book on ciphers and cryptology, began with an introductory poke at the dim-witted common man. He said, quote, "This I did, that to men of learning and men deeply engaged in the study of magic, it might, by the grace of God, be in some degree intelligible, while on the other hand, to the thick-skinned turnip-eaters, it might for all time remain a hidden secret, and be to their dull intellects a sealed book forever." In the popular BBC series Blackadder, which traces the fortunes of the hapless Blackadder family dynasty from 1485 to World War I, Doofy Dogsbody Baldrick, servant to Edmund Blackadder, is noted for his multi-generational lowbrow love of turnips. The Elizabethan Baldrick was famed for his recipe for turnip surprise, which, the surprise, contains absolutely nothing but a turnip. With its vulgar associations and silly appearance, bulbous below, shaggy above, the turnip is an unlikely literary hero, but apparently it has been one since at least the 14th century. The Grimm brothers' tale, The Turnip, for example, harks back to a trio of medieval Latin poems, the gist of which is deserved comeuppance. A poor but honest farmer brings an enormous turnip as a gift to the king and receives a purse of gold as a reward. The farmer's wealthy neighbor, or occasionally his half-brother, depending on the story, then decides to give the king a horse, hoping for an even bigger and better reward. Instead, he gets the turnip. Introduced to England by the invading Romans along with apples, lavender, and peas, the turnip led a career of relative obscurity until it came to the attention of Charles, 2nd Viscount Townshend. Townshend, later nicknamed Turnip Townshend, was a passionate agriculturist who in the early 1700s promoted the turnip both as livestock feed and as part of a four-crop cycle of crop rotation with sequential plantings of wheat, barley, turnips, and clover. Daniel Defoe, tramping through Townshend's home country of Norfolk in 1724, wrote, quote, "This part of England is remarkable for being the first where the feeding and fattening of sheep and other cattle with turnips was practiced, a very great part of the improvement of their lands to this day." King George II was so impressed with the Norfolk turnips that he had an instructional report written about them for the edification of his subjects across the Channel in Hanover. Even the irascible William Cobbett admired the Norfolk turnip fields. Jane Austen's Mr. Knightley, the love interest in Emma, grew turnips. Turnips were first planted in America by Jacques Cartier, who tended a kitchen garden in Quebec in 1541 while fielding expeditions to collect what he fondly believed were gold and diamonds. They turned out to be iron pyrite and quartz crystals, which inspired the contemporaneous French expression, quote, "fake as Canadian diamonds," unquote. The Jamestown colonists planted turnips in Virginia. "Our English seeds thrive very well here," wrote Alexander Whitaker in Good News of Virginia in 1612, a bolstering report to the colonists' backers in London, citing the pleasant climate, the abundant low wildlife, and the success of peas, onions, turnips, and cabbages. Turnips also grew in the gardens of Massachusetts Bay. A letter from Governor John Winthrop to his wife in Boston sends kisses, inquires after the children, and reminds her to get in the turnips. John Randolph, in his Treatise on Gardening, 1793, lists the white and purple-rooted turnip as best for the table. At Monticello, Thomas Jefferson, who ate turnips with sugar in ragouts, grew 10 different kinds. By the 19th century, seed catalogs offered dozens of different turnip varieties. D.M. Ferry in 1881 listed 21. Burpee in 1888 carried 16, including the white egg and the cowhorn, a white carrot-shaped variety, and the golden ball or orange jelly, noted for rich, sweet, pulpy flesh. Vilmorin Andros, The Vegetable Garden, which was 1885, describes 45 different kinds, among them carrot-shaped, round, and flat turnips, which last in illustrations look somewhat like hockey pucks. The notable success of the turnip paved the way for the rutabaga, which is neither turnip nor cabbage, but somewhere in between. While the cabbage has 18 chromosomes and the turnip 20, the rutabaga, which cheerfully incorporates both, has 38. Scientists guess that the crucial combination mating took place at some point in the Middle Ages, possibly in Scandinavia, where the cool climate park particularly suits them. The first written mention of the rutabaga occurs in 1620, usually attributed to Swiss botanist Gaspard, or Caspar, Bauen, who saw some growing in Sweden. This makes sense, since the common name comes from the Swedish rutabaga, root bag. It is also variously known as the Swede, the yellow turnip, or the turnip-rooted cabbage. There's less overwrought reverence for the turnip nowadays. It comes in dead last in the National Garden Association's list of most popular American garden vegetables, and a lot of seed catalogs leap insouciantly from tomatoes to watermelon without a turnip ward glance. Some historians hypothesize that public repudiation of turnips is a holdover from World Wars I and II, when people periodically were condemned to live on nothing but. In the turnip winter of 1916-17, for example, due to Allied blockade and potato failure, starving Germans turned to turnips, transmogrifying them with varying degrees of success into everything from coffee to marmalade and bread. Food shortages in World War II Britain led to a resurgence of turnips, often baked into Woolton pie, which was named after Frederick Marquis Baron Woolton, the wartime minister of food. "A horrible dish has appeared on the dining room table," wrote an unhappy consumer, "and it is to be repeated once a week. It is called Woolton pie. It is composed entirely of root vegetables in which one feels turnip has far too honored a place." One mother claimed that the very mention of Woolton pie, her 6-year-old son would burst into uncontrollable sobs. Understandably, post-war, everybody hated turnips, along with Spam, blackout curtains, and sirens. But given what turnips have done for us, they really deserve a whole lot better. Hope you enjoyed that. I'm Nancy Williams for The Zesty Garden. I'm not going to share a turnip recipe with you today, so don't go looking for it. Love you. See you next time. Bye-bye.
Zesty Garden is a production of Utah Public Radio with producer Shalane Smith-Needham and Brian Earle. To listen to past programs or get additional information about the show, just go to upr.org. If you have an idea for an interview, including guests or topics, send your suggestions to zestygarden@gmail.com. You're listening to KUST HD1 Moab, KCEU Price, KUSL HD1 Richfield, KUSK HD1 Vernal, KUSR HD1 Logan, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.